WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio at FairToFlare.com. My name's Jason Mann, and today I am with Gino Morosco of MMA Mania. Gino, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, it has. Today we are going to continue our SummerSlam main event series with the main event of SummerSlam 1990. The Ultimate Warrior WWE Champion against Rick Rude in a steel cage match. And this is sort of, well, a rematch from SummerSlam 89, which was Warrior and Rude for the Intercontinental Championship. Warrior regaining it after he'd lost it from Rude to 1990, or at WrestleMania 5 in 89. So the kind of the hook here was that Rude had beaten Warrior before, sort of had his number, and also that Warrior had actually never been in a cage match before, and Rude had cage match experience. So the idea being that Rude would be wise enough to take advantage of that experience, although it turns out that Rude did not really use his wisdom very well in this match.
Yeah, it was a weird match. They did a good job. The announcers did a good job with putting it over in terms of it being in the cage and, you know, the steel cage. And it was McMahon, who was always good with that kind of stuff, and making sure to stop at various points when there was a lull in the action. And in this match, there was plenty of that. To make sure to say, oh, and remember, it's the steel cage, and, you know. And Piper, who he was kind of weird on commentary throughout the, I noticed when I rewatched it, it was like he would kind of go in and out from being like, he would kind of, like when he was harping on Warrior, when he was doing his pump up thing with his arms.
Yeah, he was really heelish on Warrior.
Which is
very strange. I kind of vaguely remember him doing that before during the show, but he was hardcore about it. I mean, it wasn't subtle at all. It wasn't like, he was really, I mean, it was basically he was being Jesse Ventura, just being, Roddy Piper being Jesse Ventura.
Every time he did it, he's like, what is he doing? What is that for? Why does he keep doing that? Tell me, McMahon. And McMahon's like, he's drawing the power from all the Warriors. And,
right. He made fun of Warrior's tassels, too, said that Rude should tie them to the cage.
But he would kind of go in and out, It's like he didn't keep that the whole way, but almost like he couldn't help himself.
Yeah, yeah, maybe he just really didn't like Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah, like the rest of us. He's like, man, yeah. That made it kind of cool, actually, that he's just like, what's he doing?
Yeah. Insane guy, yeah. I watched the pre-match promos, and I thought there was one line by Warrior that made me laugh, although not in the way it was intended. He says, I'm going to paraphrase, but he says, do you know what Rude and Heenan have in common with Liberty Bell? One is cracked and the other is a ding dong, which I thought was pretty much like a John Cena level joke. Like, it reminded me very much of John Cena. And having the Ultimate Warrior, having that come out of his mouth when he normally had the, like, incomprehensible ravings of a madman kind of thing was very odd.
It's funny because when I rewatched everything, when I found this out earlier, rewatch it, and I'd like you do, I jotted down a few notes. And that was one of the things I jotted down to make sure to bring up was the pre-match promos that they always used to do that, they'd cut to the back. Rude would do his promo, Warrior would do his promo, and they were both really goofy.
Yes.
And like goofy in the wrong way, like you said. Warrior comes out with this joke, which falls completely flat, and they break the tension by having, what's his name? Why can't I think of it? Doing the interview. Mean Gene. They have Mean Gene start laughing, and Warrior laughs with him, and then Warrior does, like, the thing where he kind of scoffs at him or whatever, like, real loud. And
right.
Mean Gene stops laughing.
Yeah.
So that kind of saved it a little bit, but it was just so painfully cheesy. And like you said, such a break from what we're used to.
Yeah.
From Warrior just being a complete nut job, that it was just like you just couldn't help but shake your head. Mm-hmm. But then Rude wasn't any better, because he said, and I thought this was hilarious to me, I couldn't quit laughing. He brought up Rocky because they were in Philadelphia.
Yes.
So you wanted to, they both used the cultural references and to massive failure.
Yes.
And Rude brings up Rocky and he goes, you know, the Rocky story or whatever, when he stepped in against Apollo Creed, something like that. And he's like, the difference between that is that was a movie and this is reality.
Yes.
I couldn't quit laughing. I'm like, Rude, there's no way you just really actually said that. Like,
yeah.
Back then, I'm sure, you know what, in 1990, that probably would have flew just fine. I guess
yes.
Today, that being a fan today and being, you know, being my age, 24 years old, and hearing that now is just like, oh my God. He did not just say that. This is reality. Yeah.
Rude was oddly monotone in that promo also, which I like. Rude's generally a good promo, so I just, whatever reason, he did not seem, that was not a strong effort from him. It just, in general, just his tone and his whole like vibe was not very strong there. He seemed oddly unconfident for whatever reason.
Super scripted almost. Like
he
after he did that, like they did the camera turn and he did a real slow turn to the camera and there was like, excuse me, there was like 8 seconds. Well, maybe it wasn't 8, but even if it was 5, it was like there was like 5 whole seconds of no one said anything. And they just waited, and Rude started talking again.
Yeah.
It was like a really awkward silence. Like, he just might have slipped up right there. Like, he totally forgot where he was supposed to go.
Yeah, it looked like he was almost like reading like a teleprompter. It looked like like John Morrison kind of talking.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's perfect. Yeah, I like Morrison, but yeah, he almost seemed like that. Like, just really, yeah, really, like it's chopped together almost. Like, no, there's nothing fluid about it.
Yeah, but...
And like you said, Rude used to be super, super good on the mic. He used to be... You know, he kind of saved it, actually, when he came out, and he did his usual pre-match, grab the mic, tell everyone to shut up. He called them Pennsylvania piss ants.
Yes.
Saved it, as I said. So he's forgiven. He's forgiven for the mess-up with the this is reality.
Right. Yeah, Rude was great. I really, really always thought Rude is fantastic. And, you know, the thing about Rude is that he would do the gyrations and he would do, like, the movements, like, maybe even almost, like, effeminate movements. But, like, Rude was, like, personality-wise, he was, like, such a man. Like, he was such a man's man. Like, it's kind of weird that, you know, like, a lot of those characters will sort of be, like, flamboyant and kind of play off the gay thing a little bit. I mean, they won't necessarily be, like, coded as gay, but they'll have certain, like, they'll get the heat that way to a certain extent, but Rude didn't do that.
Yeah.
Like, in fact, a major part of Rude's character was that he's a womanizer, that he would, you know, pull women out of the crowd and kiss them and be like, you know, it was kind of a ladies man. It's just kind of a different take on that style of heel, you know?
Yeah, super, super body conscious. And they all are to an extent, but he was like you said, taking it to the extent like you would expect of a woman.
Yeah.
Even though he was the womanizing type.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, with the hair that was always perfect, and even when he cut it off, it was always, you know what I mean, it was a big point.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can totally see what you're saying. Yeah, like the contrast, and but he was still he made it work perfectly. He was an awesome, awesome heel.
Oh,
they booed the hell out of him.
Oh yeah, yeah, he was great. I mean, and this is Philadelphia too, which is, I mean, this is 1990, granted, but Philadelphia was still kind of more of a heel town. You know, I mean, if this match took place today, they would cheer Rude, you know, out of the building, and Warrior would be booed out of the building, you know.
Yeah.
And in 1990, they were, you know, they were really into Warrior, and I mean, they were into Rude and into hating him, but they, you know, there was no, you know, there were, you know, no smart chance or not like a really, at least I didn't notice anyone, you know, cheering for Rude during this match. So
it seemed a little flat, I thought. I mean, they didn't have any reason not to be, but I mean, it just seemed a little flat.
Okay. I didn't particularly notice it being particularly flat, but you know, I'll defer to you in that. I thought it was okay crowd anyway.
Yeah.
You know, not out of the ballpark by any means, but so we started off with a Warrior climbing the cage, Rude meeting him up there. Then Rude sort of gets slammed and falls. A Warrior goes to the top and hits the axe handle and slams Rude's face in the cage a little bit. Then He charges into Rude, but misses and hits the cage face first. So Rude takes control a little bit. He climbs, but Warrior grabs onto him. Rude kicks him, but then falls and falls with a punch. Rude's bleeding a little bit, and then he throws Warrior face first into the cage and slams him hard again. So I thought pretty good action to start off with. Interesting that they kind of started at the top of the cage, of all things. It was kind of weird that Warrior seemed like he had the opportunity where he could have just climbed in and then climbed right back out. I don't know the rules on that sort of thing. I consult my rule book, but.
Right. I had a lot of small issues with the match, and that was the first one. Mm-hmm. You have to obviously get past Warrior and coming out and doing like six laps around the cage for reasons no one will ever understand.
Yeah.
Just blowing himself up. So, of course, the match has to go, like you said, solid action, but it had to go at a slower pace, obviously, so he could recover.
Yeah.
And not totally blow his wad. And the match wasn't even that long anyway.
It was about 10 minutes, really. Yeah.
Was it 10 minutes? Yeah, it didn't seem very long. So he just kills himself by just doing laps for whatever reason. And then he climbs up on the cage, and I'm fine with how they're doing this, and that's fine, and he hits Rude. And then they ring the bell, and he's not even in the cage yet. And I'm going, wait a minute, what? Like, maybe that's petty on my part, but he's not even in the cage, and they made a really big point, and rightfully so, it's what you should do in that situation. They made a huge point of the two ways to win, which is the ref, the pinfall, obviously, that's the only, and they... That's another thing I liked about McMahon. The ref was in there, and he made sure to say, I think, at least once or twice, that the only reason the ref's in there is to count the pin.
Mm-hmm.
Because naturally people would watch and go, why do you need a ref if anything goes?
Right.
So I like that they did that. But then the other one, obviously, like you said, was he could have just dropped down to the floor, which is how he ultimately ended up winning. But it's like he's not even in the cage yet. He punches him. Rude goes off. They already rang the bell, so just jump down, and you win.
Yeah, this is the first WWE cage match that I can remember that had pinfalls, because they were all before this, and I mean even until the late 90s, they were all just escape the cage.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, Brett and Owen at SummerSlam '94, that's escape the cage. There's no pinfalls in that one, and
it makes more sense that way.
To just have escape the cage.
Yeah, because the ref, it's really awkward to have the ref there. Like, the refs, I don't know where they got there, what kind of training they give these guys. They do an awesome, awesome job of not taking away any attention from the action in the ring. Like, you never seem to notice them.
Yeah.
And that's great. But there are times that you can't help but notice them because they have to run and get out of the way, and there's just not a lot of reason to have them in there. And especially with the cage, it becomes more, it kind of amplifies the fact that they're there.
Yeah, and you don't have the same kind of camera coverage where you can, shoot around them, or, you're limited in how you can shoot a cage match, obviously, so they're more noticeable that way, too. It's weird that they had it. I completely forgotten that they had a near... I mean, they only had one near fall, I think, in this match, so it wasn't really... barely even played into it, but...
Yeah, didn't matter at all. Didn't matter at all.
But it was just odd that... It was odd how they did that. I prefer a cage match where it's just pinfalls or submissions and that's it. I prefer that. I don't really love escape the cage. I think it's better if there's like eight guys or something and you kind of have that. I think that escape the cage kind of works better in that situation. That's a neat type of match, but just one-on-one I prefer just pinfall or submission and just kind of working the cage and just having a big, tough, big fight, inside the cage. I think that's kind of a better thing. The climbing spots, I don't know, that it's just always seems like it's a guy, trying to escape away from another guy, which usually it's the good guy and you were like, oh no, the good guy should fight. The good guy shouldn't escape, just kind of, I don't know. It's always been kind of a silly thing for WWE style cage matches to do that.
And the timing is so hard to get down, and I can't, like, I've never been in a steel cage match in WWE before, but you can imagine, and you see it a lot, is like the situations where somebody takes, let's say a big bump, and back then they didn't really have a whole lot of big bumps, although they did a couple in this match, surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
But they do a big bump or whatever, and the guy, he's laying there and he's hurt. He's selling that he just took a really big hit, whatever, and the other guy goes, okay, now I go out. Well, they have to time it upright to where the guy doesn't escape too fast so as to where the guy has to jump up real quick and then completely act like he's not hurt anymore. Excuse me, just so he can get to him in time to make the save, versus the opposite, which is you crawl out ridiculously slow, which is just, you know what I mean? There comes a point where, you know, if the whole thing is to suspend your disbelief, you just can't do it at that point. Because it's like,
yeah, kind of,
you're overdoing it by how slow you're going. And that was
right.
the ladder matches. That's the biggest problem with ladder matches. It's just the slow climb.
Yeah.
And they're never hauling ass up there like you know they should be. Like, just go get it.
They're a little better at that now.
They're a lot better.
Most of the ladder matches are multi-man ladder matches, so you don't have, you know, but you're right. A lot of the older ladder matches have that issue. I mean, even Michaels and Razor Ramon, yeah, I remember that was kind of one of the things. It's like, oh, you know, he's climbing really slow now, you know,
kind of thing. Yeah, and that would set the bar for all ladder matches. And then that would have those problems. It's just, you know, to get it perfect is, you know, it's impossible to expect perfection, even from, you know, like HBK, who, you know, is the best.
Right. Sure. Yeah, there is that issue. There's also when you get to the top, like the guy has to pull the guy back in, and like, you know, you realize like, oh, it's kind of silly that, you know, he's able to be able to lift him from that position, or, you know, just kind of pull him back in. Obviously, the guy has to be willing to be brought back in. So there's a lot of realism issues in these. So
extremely dangerous too, and they're good about it for the most part, but there's instances like, you know, it's going off topic, but we're talking about the ladder matches, like the Money in the Bank. You saw all that, yeah, I'm sure, because you reviewed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Raw one?
Yeah.
That was, like I said, that's why I thought a good podcast would be the crowd. The crowd was so hot for everything that it kind of seemed like it wasn't, like it was, everything seemed a lot better than it was because of how great the crowd was. Mm-hmm. I think that match probably benefited the most.
Mm-hmm.
Because it legitimately seemed like somebody was going to get hurt or somebody was even going to die. Like, it was really, the Swagger's fall was super scary. And I think Kofi on that fall hit himself in the face on the rope.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it looked like he actually got hurt pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
And there was multiple spots. Miz falling down. I actually, this is going even further off topic, but I got called out on Twitter. Because when I was watching that, when it happened, I thought he actually hurt his knee.
No, I thought I did too. I mean, it looked he did, you know.
Yeah, and then I went on Twitter. I was like, oh man, he really messed up his knee. He comes running back out, and then my buddy Sergio or whatever, he just sent me a Twitter message, just one word, Mark, in all big letters.
Mm-hmm.
And they got me, man. And that's when wrestling's great, when you're to the point we are as fans, to be so far in it, and you're so far gone. If you can trick me even one time, That's why I love wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I actually thought it hurt. He did a great job.
Yeah, he did. He did a really great job. Yeah. back to the topic.
Speaking of good cell jabs, there's a couple of those in this match.
Yeah. Yeah. They kind of trade some strikes and stumble along. Warrior gets a chop, but then Rude rakes his face and smashes Warrior's head into the bars. Rude tries the Rude Awakening, the neck breaker, but Warrior's able to power out.
I don't mean to cut you off, but that was another point that it was kind of like another small thing, but the Rude Awakening kind of seemed like there was no setup. Like, he just sort of went for it.
Well, he twisted. Well, I mean, he didn't really work the neck or anything, but.
Yeah, I mean, well, it was like they kicked him, and then he just went for it. Like,
yeah.
There was no.
I think this was kind of a time where there wasn't a whole lot of emphasis put on psychology setting up finishers. I think that basically every finisher was considered absolutely deadly, so no setup was necessary. Basically, the idea is this guy hits this finisher, you're dead, you're gone. So you don't really need to set it up, I guess, is sort of.
I read a lot of wrestling books, and you're right, that was totally the case. Like, that's, these days it's not like that at all, but like, it used to be a big deal if a guy said, okay, you can kick out of my finisher.
Right.
Like, that used to actually mean something. Like, now it's, you know, they have these matches where they, just to make them epic, you have to kick out of a finisher like 5 times,
mm-hmm.
you know, and have like 8 near falls and stuff like that. I don't know. It just seemed kind of weird that it was just like, you know, they were, you know, he was just regular action, and then suddenly he's going for his finisher. And then McMahon's like, oh yeah, and he gets, oh, he's going for it. You know what I mean? I don't know. Maybe you're right. Maybe I'm just too used to the series of setup moves and the sort of build up to it.
Yeah. I mean, it was. I mean, we're 5-6 minutes into the match, so I mean, it's early in the match. I can see where you're coming from, but I do think that I don't think a fan at that point would have thought, you know, the same thing, because I think that just the style was different enough, and because you know the epicness of finishers, so to speak.
Yeah,
Warrior was able to power out of the first one. Then he hits a short arm clothesline and then goes for the splash, but lands on Rude's knee. So Rude is able to hit the second Rude Awakening. And this is the point where Rude's goes against Bobby Heenan's advice, doesn't seem to use his caged wisdom, so to speak. And instead of taking the opportunity to escape, he goes to the very top of the cage and comes down with a fist. And then he goes up even again the second time, but then Warrior's able to get a punch to the gut the second time. Warrior crawls for the door, but Heenan is able to make himself useful by slamming it right into his head, which then Rude covers, and there's a near fall for two, which was, again, the first point that I realized there were near falls. The ref's presence in the ring just apparently eluded me the entire time. I didn't even, you know, think about that. So
he was doing his job then.
Yeah, exactly. So we get a double clothesline. They're both down for a little bit. Rude crawls to the door, and Heenan sort of helps him out, but Heenan or Warrior, rather, grabs the ankle and then grabs the tights, so we get the treat of seeing Rude's backside.
Full,
yeah, full moon.
Exactly.
It was all the way out, yeah. The angle, the angle, you didn't really see it that well, but yes.
Yes. Strategic camera placement, just to make sure, you know, because it was still 1990, and the crowd's going, ah, you know what I mean? Oh, my God, his ass is out. But, yes. They never switched. They never panned around at all. It stayed on the same camera.
I went to a house show in 87, or I think it was 87, and it was a Hercules-Randy Savage match. Hercules was the heel, Savage was the face, and I think the finish was Savage pulling Hercules' tights down, so he mooned, and then kind of rolling him up for the pin. So,
yeah.
So I had seen bare ass in the WWE show before. So.
There's an effect for the live crowd. It doesn't translate that well on TV, but
right.
You get the point. It bothered me to an extent. There was another point. This was another small thing where he neutralized completely Rude, but that's all he did. Because then at that point, that's where they wanted to have. That's what happens next is he grabs Heenan, because Heenan's right there. So of course Warrior grabs Heenan, and Heenan was like the greatest manager ever at taking bumps.
Yeah.
So there's nothing I love more than a guy who can take one punch and do like four flips.
Yes.
And that's how he is. So of course they get him in to take his bumps, but all Warrior did that would have Rude incapacitated and seemingly recovering over on the side was the pants thing.
Yes.
Where he just kind of pulled his ass out and then he just left him there, and Rude's rolling around on the other side like he's seriously injured. He was just about to climb up right before that.
Well, to be fair, Heenan was helping him out, so maybe Rude wasn't able to climb out on his own.
That's true. I guess that's true.
All right. Woohoo.
Yeah. Small victory.
I'm saving the psychology of this match.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I'm just harping on it a little too much.
That's all right.
Little small things like that. I was just like,
yeah. No, I definitely can see what you mean. I didn't think of it at the time, but it does make sense. Yeah. Again, in 1990, not the strongest year for in-ring psychology for WWE matches in general. This was kind of the point where it was really, you know, the muscled up guys and really, you know, the workers, like Santana was still there, but he was marginalized. Steamboat was gone. Rude was about to leave. He was done pretty much after this. Went to WCW later in 1990. Yeah. And, you know, Valentine was, you know, in his Rhythm and Blues days. I mean, the guy, because, you know, what I kind of consider the golden era, the 85 to 88 into 89. I mean, you know, there was such a strong tag division. There was such strong workers. I mean, yeah, you had your Hogan doing your Hogan matches, and you had your big fat guys, and you had, you know, I mean, you definitely had the slower, you know, more traditional Northeast style, but you also, I mean, they brought in, you know, some of the really great world-class, fast-paced, incredible workers, you know, who could fill the mid card with great matches. I mean, it's sort of what led, you know, WCW kind of had the same formula in the late 90s. I mean, they did it more with the, you know, the cruiserweights and some of the Southern style guys, but you know, you had a, you know, you had a heavy you know, a concentration of great wrestling, and then you had Hogan and, you know, friends doing their thing as well, but you had like a balance of a lot of different things. But by 1990, you really had like a bunch of big muscled up guys, really mostly cartoonish personalities, and you had kind of everyone, not everyone doing exactly the same thing, but you had, you know, the guys who were really doing great matches and were, you know, still the great workers. It was definitely a very much a smaller group by then.
Yeah, fewer and far between. And you said Hogan was still there doing his thing. And, you know, that was, you know, this was kind of a co-main event type of thing where it was like there was two main events, of course, because Hogan's still there and he's still hogging the spotlight.
Yeah.
And he had a match with Earthquake.
Yeah.
And how's that match going to go? You don't need any psychology. Earthquake, well, psychology to the extent of Earthquake's big. He uses his mask to dominate Hogan for most of the time. Hogan, of course, gets dominated like he's so good at doing.
Yeah.
And then makes his big comeback with the weak muscles, still somehow manages to body slam him, gets the pin with the leg drop.
Yeah.
There's not much to it. You don't need to really go anything into that. I think the best match on the card was a tag team match with the Hart Foundation and Demolition.
Yeah, that's a great match.
No surprise. I think it got the most time, too, that it went the longest.
Yeah, and it didn't go out,
in the main event.
It didn't really go that long either. I mean, it went like 15 minutes. And it was a 2 out of 3 falls match. So,
yeah.
Yeah, actually, SummerSlam 90 is a pretty fun show. There's also completely random Power and Glory destroying the Rockers, of all things. I don't know.
Love Power and Glory. But
yeah,
I
think it's mostly the. I think it's mostly the superplex splash combo. I think, you know, and I, whatever reason, Paul Roma and Hercules had some chemistry together. I always kind of liked Hercules, actually. And actually, Paul Roma, I mean, you know, he was obviously not a good fit for the Horsemen or whatever, but, it, you know, as far as a decent tag wrestler, he was pretty good.
Yeah, that was like the tag boom. Now that we're talking about it, like Demolition and the Rockers and...
Yeah,
Power and Glory.
This was kind of the end of it, or near the end of it. But
yeah,
there were, you know, because I mean, I think it was stronger in 87, 88. I mean, you had Killer Bees, you had Rougeaus, you had Still Heart Foundation, Demolition, Strike Force. I mean, you had you probably had a little bit of a deeper team, but you still had some really strong ones. I mean, you know, Brainbusters. I think they were gone by then, but they had been there in 89 and all. You know, I mean, you did have a really good mix of teams. It was kind of when LOD came in, which I guess LOD actually was involved in that.
I was gonna say they were there. They did a few things, but I guess they were the version of WCW's later tactics of having the great matches on the bottom of the card with the little guys, and then you'd lead into the, you know, like you said, the plotting guys like Hogan and Nash and whatever. Like that's what the tag division essentially was.
Yeah,
they were the ones having all the great matches.
Right.
Using all the psychology.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean they were really having those, you know, the great matches. And the Hogan Earthquake thing, I mean, the kind of the big thing that people remember is the big angle where Earthquake destroyed Hogan on the Brother Love show, and then Hogan had to be hospitalized, and they had a big, like, you know, campaign to, you know, send cards and letters to Hogan, and then they were showing his recovery and stuff, and so forth. I'll admit that this was kind of the time when I sort of stopped really being into wrestling. Like, this was kind of the year that my interest kind of started to wane a bit here and there. And it kind of went back and forth throughout 90 and 91 and 92. And then by mid 92, I was pretty much, once they didn't do Hogan Flair at WrestleMania 8, that was kind of when I was done. Cause that was kind of the thing that I was still kind of holding on to. And when it's like when Hogan was leaving and they weren't going to do it, I was kind of like, not so much. And I didn't really get, I mean, I would kind of go back and watch old like pay-per-view tapes and would, you know, catch back up with it maybe like once a year or twice a year. But I was basically until 96, 97, I really, you know, was kind of out of being a wrestling fan for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, you weren't the only one, because that was entering into the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
Exactly what a lot of people refer to it as, because that's when, you know, because eventually it just got to a point where Hogan was still, and, you know, it always sounds like I blame him for everything, and I guess I really do, but Hogan was just still, it couldn't help but be pushed down our throats with the same gimmick and no change at all ever. And it's no surprise that by the time wrestling really hit and got back big again, it's when he did the complete turn from that gimmick to the complete other opposite side of it. And then, boom. And I'm not saying it was all him, because he didn't have anything to do with Stone Cold Steve Austin or The Rock or all those guys.
Sure.
But he obviously played a big part in it and the whole outsider's angle or whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was definitely, there wasn't a lot to, I mean, for people that didn't watch during that time, they missed out on a lot of great stuff. You know, Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart were having insanely great matches.
Yeah.
Pretty much all the time. I mean, Bret Hart having a 4.5-star match with the 1-2-3 kid on a Raw.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like that, and that was like 93, 94 or whatever, when Raw first came around.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of people would miss stuff like that because there's just no, there's really no reason to, it felt stale at that point. And it's like now, it's been stale for a long time, and people are just now finally, you know, I'm seeing people on Twitter that have talked about how haven't liked wrestling for years, but then they're going, hey, you know, the CM Punk guy. This is kind of cool.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that can, you know, shake things up, obviously. And yeah, the thing about Hogan is also, like, you know, he very much had, like, he had two types of feuds. Like, he had, like, the big monster type feuds, and he had the partner who turned on him type feuds.
Yep.
And at that point, I'd seen enough of those. Like, the Earthquake feud reminded me a lot of the King Kong Bundy feud, which I'd seen in 86. It was just kind of like, oh, this is the same thing he did. It's even, like, injured ribs again, you know? So,
tape on the ribs and all that. It's
like, yeah. And at that, you know, there were a lot of fans in 1990 who hadn't been fans in 86, so they hadn't seen that. But, you know, I had. So, you know, it was something that it was just like, oh, and it's the same thing again. It's just kind of hard to, you know, I mean, they very much had their formulas with Hogan and with, you know, everything. I mean, they really, you know, the way their storytelling, the way they cycled through, I mean, even throughout the year, I mean, even, you know, SummerSlam itself, I mean, this was a kind of a departure from the norm of, you know, this double main event. I mean, 88, 89, they had basically the big tag match was the main event, and in 91 as well, where they had, you know, the two top baby faces against, you know, the kind of two top heels, and, you know, kind of combining the feuds they'd had throughout, you know, from WrestleMania before on. It was just kind of, you know, an extension basically of what had happened at WrestleMania. So, and then this obviously sort of being different from that because of the, you know, was the unusual babyface versus babyface Hogan Warrior at, you know, WrestleMania thing. So, you know, they
felt limited. Yeah, just felt really limited with, you know, they eventually obviously got away with that and started doing really a lot more complex storylines. And that's not to say they didn't have, you know, deep layers to, like, you know, Hogan and Savage and Elizabeth, and, like, there was, you know, they did a good job with that storytelling with stuff like that, but
yeah,
for the most part, though, it just felt super, super limited, and just not, there was not a lot of depth to it, and, you know, that didn't come back until, like you said, people started getting back into it, and they hiring, you know, daytime soap opera writers who were making it, you know, and that sucked us in, and it's kind of lame to say that almost, it feels kind of lame that we got sucked in by writers like that, but it worked. It really did. We want to care about a certain story arc that isn't too crazy, but isn't so simple, like you said, as just, you know, he's a big guy, and I can take him out, and no, you can't. And, you know, and then the eventual matches, I mean, how much can Hogan and Earthquake, as great as Earthquake was for his size and all that, but how much can they really do?
And Hogan was clearly an autopilot when it came to wrestling at this point, too, you know. And, you know, I mean, granted, he had a lot of success, and, you know, it's probably tough to come up with new ideas when you're on. I mean, even though he had time off here and there, and he had a better schedule than everyone, he was still on the road a lot. And, you know, so you can kind of understand it was working well enough that, you know, okay, we'll just stick with it because it works well enough. And that's, you know, and you know, people are human. They tend to do that. You know, it's understandable in one sense, but obviously it sort of led to, you know, it led to being less interesting for me and for a lot of other people. But
yeah, well, I won't hold it against him because, like I said, he's big too. You know, he lumbers. You know, he's not very fluid in his motion, so it's obviously that kind of makes him limited unless he's got somebody really great to work off of.
Yeah. And,
you know, there just weren't that many guys that they were willing to let him do that with.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Hogan versus a small guy wouldn't sell in 1990. You mean Savage?
Hogan Henning would never work.
Yeah, well, I mean, they tried it and it actually did kind of poorly. So
exactly.
Yeah,
it didn't work that well. Although, right. Looking back on it, you know what I mean. And like, I was watching not that long ago. I was watching could have been the 1990 Rumble, where Hogan won, and I think Henning was the last guy he eliminated.
Yeah. Yeah,
I love that. I love that because, and Henning's the perfect guy that he can act like he's like Heenan. He was that guy. He was, and Michaels and the really good sell guys. Like if Hogan punches him once, even lightly, he can act like he just got shot in the face with a shotgun.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like he's just great at that.
They had some TV matches. They never did a pay per view match or anything, but they had some. I mean, they did a house show thing, and I think they had a Saturday Night's Main Event match. So
yeah, man.
So they did. I mean, they obviously they worked together, but didn't have a big program like, you know, a lot of Hogan's ones. You know, not as well remembered anyway. But
Warrior, you know, as good as the match was at WrestleMania 6. I mean, when you rewatch it, there's so little. I don't know. Again, though, it's like it's kind of going back to the changed landscape of what a great match is now versus what it was then, which is because now it's like. You end up going, well, you know, we've seen these crazy matches with the Hardys and Edge and Christian and all those guys. So that's kind of, you know, the spot matches. So there's that way of seeing things and that way of having a good match. And then versus matches like Undertaker and Triple H where they mix those in with just solid technical wrestling. And then matches like Punk and Cena even where it's just like they didn't do anything too extreme and still managed to have a really good match.
Yeah. Definitely.
With Hogan and Warrior, it just felt slow, but more meaning behind everything they did.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it seems like we don't have that as much anymore. And that's probably part of why Punk Cena was so great, because everything felt like it meant something really, really big.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the atmosphere, obviously, was a big. And that was a big for Hogan Warrior, too.
Yep.
Anyway, the finish of Warrior Rude, going back to that.
We always do this every time we just it goes off. That's what's great about wrestling though. Every time conversation about it, it's miles away from what we started at. But the finish to this match was awesome, and that's the one thing I will not harp on. And Warrior really impressed me with what he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the you know Warrior does his. Does his motion for the press slam, which Piper keeps questioning, and Rude's able to land a clothesline, but Warrior shakes the ropes, hits repeated clotheslines, motions for the press slam, which again, Piper, what does that mean? And then, this one it seemed pretty obvious that he was going to go for a press slam, but so it didn't seem like Piper needed to ask that. But he hit it, and then he climbs the cage, and then as he's going down, he does a mock gyration that Rude would do, sort of a really cocky thing to do to end it, which Warrior could do that every once in a while. He would sort of, you know, shove it in somebody's face, so to speak. And then he wins and or goes down to the floor. He wins, and then he climbs back up the cage, poses up there, and twirls the belt as he's up near the top. So, cool finish.
Perfect ending to a match that, you know, I mean, let's face it, was mostly mediocre. I mean, nothing super special about it. There was nothing that was all that memorable other than maybe the ending there where he's crawling out and he makes sure to stop. And as Rude's getting up and stumbling around the ring to do the Rude, you know what I mean, gyrating his hips thing straight at him and then drops down and the crowd eats it up. I thought that was great. I
mean, yeah.
He redeemed himself right there.
Yeah. It was an entertaining enough match. I mean, it was quick and painless. It's, you know, it's if you... You know, it's certainly not an essential by any stretch of the imagination, but it's perfectly fine, and I'd call it entertaining. I'd say it was fun. If you haven't seen Rude Warrior, it's kind of a decent look at what they would do. Rude, you know, was along with Savage were the guys who really brought the most out of Warrior. I think Savage was on even a different level, but Rude also was able to do it too. And then Rude would move on and have, you know, really a couple of really strong in-ring years in WCW, and then unfortunately would suffer a back injury and never be able to wrestle again. And then, you know, when he was, as a manager in WCW, unfortunately passed away very young. So
There was, it was the kind of thing where someone could watch it and feel like Warrior was actually decent.
Right.
Probably more a function of being in there with Rude than anything else, like you said. So
yeah,
that's kind of a testament to how good Rude was. He was really good, yeah. That's kind of something that I had forgotten, going back and watching it and kind of seeing him in action. And this wasn't even one of his, like, really great matches. And to still be able to see how talented he was.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and he was really, yeah, his bumping and his selling and just kind of the little things he would do to express pain in his face and to, he was really good at making every movement count. I mean, he really was very, very strong at that. Yeah, and he was a little bit less like, I you know, there was an interesting kind of shift in Rude's character from the 89 Rude to the 1990 Rude, kind of the haircut. And he kind of toned down like some of the exaggerated bumping that he would do like in 89, like, and even some, I mean, he would still do some of the gyrations and stuff, but he seemed a little more serious, a little bit more like, you know, a little bit, I guess maybe the difference between like kind of being like a mid-level guy and being a main event guy was, you know, he kind of toned down that shtick a little bit and kind of was more of a kind of a, I don't want to say basic, but was just had a different shift in tone, I guess, more of a serious tone to him, at least a little bit.
Like the difference between Shawn Michaels as a rocker and Shawn Michaels as a singles wrestler.
Well, even more the difference between like the Shawn Michaels as a, like the 93 Shawn Michaels and like the 96 Shawn Michaels, I would say, you know.
I think I definitely get your point. Serious is probably the right word for it. Less gimmicky.
Yeah. Yeah, less cartoonish more, even, you know. Yeah. You know, I mean, he was still a very colorful character, but it was a little bit less like
hard. More hard.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that's the best way to express it. So.
And it was still great, maybe even better.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly when he had an awesome run in WCW. I mean, he had some great matches with Steamboat. Steamboat's obviously a guy you can have great matches with, but he really had a nice run there. Unfortunately, WCW didn't have much success when he was there, but he really did, you know, it's great matches with Sting, you know, really did, you know, was a guy, for whatever reason, you know, fit better in WCW than he did in WWE, although he did well in WWE. I mean, obviously he had a lot of success, but
different styles, like we talked about. Yeah, WCW was way less inhibited,
right,
in terms of the actual in the ring product.
Exactly,
so that suited him way better. But then it sucks because, like you said, it had less exposure, less you know, he was a lot more unheralded than he was there.
Right. Yeah. So. But yeah, anything else anyone else you want to talk about as far as the match or the show or what have you?
Yeah, well, how long before Warrior was gone at this point? Because it wasn't that long until his complete fall from grace occurred, right?
Well, no, it was another year because he
was it another year.
He lost the title
at Slaughter
at Rumble 91. Yeah,
91. Yeah.
There was the WrestleMania 7 where he beat Savage in the retirement match. Then the main event of SummerSlam 91 is Hogan Warrior against Slaughter, Mustafa, and General Adnan, the handicap match. And then Warrior chases Mustafa and Adnan off with a chair and then is never to be seen again until WrestleMania 8 when he helps Hogan when he's being attacked by Sid and Papa Shango and so forth. And then Warrior had like 6 months in 92 and then left like September, October, failed a drug test and was fired, and then didn't come back till he had another brief run in 96, and then
Triple H squash.
Yeah, the Triple H squash, and then he left after King of the Ring over some sort of dispute that he didn't go to some house shows or something, and they've suspended him, and then he was gone, and then he had the very, very bad WCW run, and that's basically end of his career. I guess he did have one match like in Europe a few years ago, but
he was teasing coming back recently.
Oh yeah, that's
I was watching those blogs he did on Hogan, and he's just as insane as ever.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, he did have a touching tribute to Savage after Savage died, but
yeah, that was shockingly well done on his part.
Yeah.
And then, as is typical fashion, completely ruined it by doing the Hogan stuff. And it's funny because I didn't And that's what I said. They posted on Cage Side, and I went in the comments there, and I said, you know, it's funny, because he's making some decent points, and all of it's probably true, but considering the source, we can't take it seriously, and we can't, you know what I mean, we can't put any weight behind it.
Right.
Because
right,
it's him sitting there and with his crazy warrior drawings behind him, and he just looks completely, I don't know, he looks weird in his older age.
Yeah.
And I follow him on Twitter, and he's a goofy guy.
I think that's a good way to put it. Yes, he's definitely a goofy guy. And that showed through in the warrior character and in pretty much everything that he does. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I just thought it was kind of weird. Like, because that was actually 1990 SummerSlam. Do you remember what we talked about before? The first time we did the podcast was Survivor Series 1990 was the big one for me.
Okay.
And when he did, he was in that with Hogan in the final. It was him and Hogan and who was Texas Tornado.
I think Santana. I think it was Santana for some
reason. It was Santana. It was Tornado the first time. In the first match or whatever. Debut of Undertaker, all those guys. Yeah, I remember that. And I was like, he used to be like such a – and it makes me remember, I guess, and even bringing that up, it makes me remember how – he was like such a god back then, like when I was so much younger. Mm-hmm. And why he was so over was just looking up to him, and I don't know, there was just something about him. And it just, and how weird it is that it so quickly escaped from that being the case. Because even the kids kind of turned off to it. Even the kids kind of just went, I don't really care anymore. You know?
Yeah.
A lot less time than it took to get tired of Hogan and his stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Warrior was more limited than Hogan, you know, I mean, he really was. I mean, you know, he didn't have the same, you know, he was more fascinating than beloved.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. Like he was somebody that you could get into, could get excited about, but he was never somebody that like, I don't recall Warrior ever having a moment where you had sympathy for him when he was fighting someone where like he had like a moment of weakness or like a moment of like being, or he would sell here or there, but it wasn't like with Hogan where he could draw you in the matches, you know, and I mean, and Hogan would do it like sometimes in the cheesiest way possible, but it would work. And I don't recall, I mean, there probably are an instance or two, but I don't recall one immediately where Warrior was able to do that.
Yeah, even being the unbeatable Hulkster, he made himself somehow vulnerable in almost every match.
Yeah.
And maybe that was just the layout of it, of getting beat on for the majority of the match so he could make his big comeback. And even knowing the big comeback was coming, and those are the times when, much to my dismay, I have to admit how truly, even if he wasn't a great wrestler, how truly talented he was that we could sit here and say that we knew the big comeback was coming. And yet there were still times when you would feel that vulnerability. You would feel that sort of, like he would, it looked like he was done. And you're right, Warrior, that was never the case. Because he just never felt that way.
Yeah, yeah, he just didn't have the same ability to bring you in emotionally. I mean, you know, the right opponent could make something decent out of him. But, I think the only match that he ever had that ever really worked on like a deep emotional level was the Savage retirement match, and that was all Savage, and that was really the Elizabeth storyline at the afterward. It was some during the match too, but even then they had to rely on Warrior kicking her out of five elbow drops too. So was just absurd at that time. So they really had to work hard to make that special and really do some things you'd never seen in a WWE ring in order to be able to do that. So I wouldn't give Warrior too much credit for that. But that's the only time where I can think of like really like a match like was just. That he was involved in, really transcended and really reached a level, beyond, just kind of, normal wrestling stuff.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if they take that stuff into account when creating a gimmick or creating a character or how someone's going to be or bringing someone in. And, like, do they think about that kind of thing where they can have a match that kind of centers around a story in which they have to showcase a lot more depth than just the normal just wrestling can convey. Like, you have to bring more out of people. Like, even like an extreme example, like Ric Flair, Shawn Michaels at Mania. And he's retiring him. And the whole way they went about it was like you could feel it the whole way, and Sean did a really good job of like even like the cheat, like you said, even if it had to be cheesy at the end, you know, and he's getting ready to give him the sweet chin music and he says, "I'm sorry, I love you." Could Warrior ever do anything anywhere even close to that? No, he couldn't.
No.
So do they, like, honestly, do you think they think of that? Like, they would go, okay, could this character, could this guy with this particular gimmick ever get to a point where we could sort of, or it could even evolve into something like that? That's another thing with Warrior. It didn't feel like that character could evolve at all. What does it evolve into?
Yeah.
More insanity?
Yeah, but look at, like, The Undertaker, for instance. I mean, you know, The Undertaker really was a very static character that didn't really have a lot of... I mean, they did a lot of, like, interesting stories with him, I guess. But it wasn't like... I mean, would you ever have thought, like, The Undertaker could become... First of all, the versatile wrestler that he became, but also, like, have a story like what he and Triple H did at WrestleMania this year? You know, kind of showing the vulnerability that he had in that match and having, you know, and obviously, you know, that's because Undertaker's a 20-year veteran who's knows the tricks. It has the equity with the audience and all that sort of thing. But I mean, so you can see characters. I mean, obviously, no one thought in 1990 that, you know, the Undertaker would last and have and be doing what he's doing in 2011. But I'm not sure my entire point is here exactly, but
It took a long time to get him there. Like Taker,
exactly, right.
Taker in 1990 was the same in 19, all the way up until the American Badass gimmick change. He was essentially the same.
I would say like 96, I think he started changing during like the Mankind feud. I would say that the character started and the Kane stuff. I think that's really kind of when there was a bit of a shift and he started showing more vulnerability and kind of adding more like emotional stuff to his character, and his style of wrestling I think changed too. It was less reliant on the like instant no selling and the gimmick, and he started kind of working in more brawling and more interesting stuff, I would say.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, because when he first started, the whole thing was that he couldn't be hurt.
Right.
So he no-sold because that's what he was supposed to do, because he's the undead, he's whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then evolved. I guess so, yeah, I mean, he gets credit, but like I said, even to that end, it still, like you said, still took a really long time to get to the point where he could have a match like he had with HBK and then with Triple H and all that stuff. So,
sure.
Yeah, just I don't know if Warrior ever could have evolved into anything close. I mean, I suppose he could have got rid of the face paint and tried to, you know, I don't know. Like, kind of had a slightly touching moment with Hogan at WrestleMania 6, you know, when they hugged and
yeah.
It was manufactured, but
yeah.
It was kind of, like, that could have been put into something where he could have, like, dropped the gimmick for a second and been like, hey, this meant something to me.
Yeah.
And then people could feel something different for him instead of, like you said, instead of just, you don't watch, like if you watch a train wreck or a car accident with like the distant eyes of someone who doesn't know anything about anyone involved, it has that sort of fascinating appeal to it of, you know, it's just something you have to see because you just have to see it. Mm-hmm. Don't even know why. You know, you should maybe even be looking at it. And that's kind of how it was with Warrior. But there's no connection there emotionally, because if there was, then it would be a lot less about seeing another one, but more about caring about the one that you're seeing now.
Yeah.
And it never felt like it could get to that point with them. It was just a series of car accidents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, actually. Yeah, I think we've really dissected the Warrior character here pretty good, actually. I was not expecting this, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that subconsciously, to answer your original question, I think subconsciously, probably people think about that to a certain extent, but I doubt, like, I think you're just trying to find something that you feel like will connect with an audience, like, at the time. Like, I'm sure you're looking for characters that won't have, like, a, you know, 6-month shelf life, like a Festus, for example. I mean, those characters are fine to have in, you know, like, the, you know, in the bottom or the middle of your card. But, you know, if you're looking for someone who you believe can be like a real, you know, main event guy, you can, you know, build around for 10 years or whatever, you are going to try to, I'm sure, try to figure out a way where, you know, he'll be able to last and that character will be able to explore different elements and so forth. And, you know, a lot of that is, I mean, it isn't just like what naturally comes from the character, but comes from, you know, what the, you know, the stories that, you know, are the writers come up with and so forth too, you know, I mean, but you are, I guess you do want a character that will be able to fit into those stories and fit into lots of different types of stories.
So. It makes me think of a conversation I had with my boss at Mania, Jesse, when we were watching, well, sometimes we'll text each other during Raw, and they were showing, they start showing the promos for Andy, Big Andy from Tough Enough,
mm-hmm.
Silent Rage,
mm-hmm.
and we're kind of just laughing back and forth to each other going, what are they going to do with this guy? What can they do with this guy? Like, honestly, like, okay, let's pretend we're the bookers, and we're the ones that have to come up with something for him, you know, like, we're creative. Like, well, all right, we're creative. What are we going to do? And I just look at him and go, you know what? I don't even know. I don't. How do you package a guy like that? You know? So it's like, it's, and it makes me think of that. Like, and I look at someone like him, and, you know, he was the wrong decision because Luke kind of, and during the show, he kind of seemed like he could have a lot more depth in terms of character development and whatever, whatever. I just don't know that Andy could ever get to a point like that. So it's like, what's the point of ever bringing him on at all? You know?
Yeah. And I don't know. I didn't watch Tough Enough. I honestly, I watched the first one.
Oh,
and I
really?
I watched the first one and I hated it so much that I didn't want to watch. I loved the Austin stuff. I loved the Austin stuff and I hated everything else. So I hated every member of the cast. They annoyed me. So and I hated all the reality show tropes that they threw in there because I don't really watch reality shows, so I wasn't really used to them, and they were just really cheesy and corny and silly, and I just. Yeah, I didn't like it. So I don't have a strong opinion on that, other than you know, in that instance in particular. But it's definitely, yeah, I wonder. You know, I'll have to see. You know, hope maybe someday if I, you know, talk to a wrestler or a WWE writer. That's a good question to ask, whether, you know, they really, you know, if they think about that when they're coming up with the characters, if they think about, like, long-term versatility and, you know, and so forth. And obviously, it depends on the performer. It depends on, you know, the type of promotion. I mean, it depends on a lot of things. So it's a hard question to answer, but it's certainly something, you know, that you would think should be thought about.
As much as we bag on it, and as much as, you know, everyone's living in a state of suspended fear on this CM Punk angle, and everyone, all the jaded wrestling fans who have dealt with so much C-Nation crap for all these years, everyone's so scared and they're on pins and needles that they're going to, quote, screw this up.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hard job. Like, even just talking about it now, it's like, I wouldn't even know where to begin if they sat me in a meeting. I don't have any experience with it, obviously, but I mean, I've been a pro wrestling fan pretty much my whole life. So you'd think I'd be able to be like, sit there and come up with something that people are going to react to, that people are going to enjoy, that are going to get people involved, like they've somehow done with Punk, to where people who have checked out and don't care anymore are going, man, you know, I want to get back into it now just because of what they're doing with this guy. And like the brilliant play that they did recently, I was watching the video today where he crashed the Comic-Con convention. And had the back and forth with Triple H, and then like they're brilliantly advancing the storyline, and it's like, what would you do next? And I'm like sitting here, and like, I have no clue, and yet I, you know, still sit here and bash him and go, well, what are they? There's nothing they can do with this guy. So yeah, I don't know. I guess the same thing. I don't know where I'm going with that so much.
That's all right. We're saying
it's a difficult job. So it's, and I guess to tie it into Warrior, it's like they probably felt handcuffed too. Like, well. What can we do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the same thing, I mean, the fans chose to root for Warrior. I mean, at some point, the fans chose him enough that he was elevated to the spot that he was elevated to. And he sort of, it wasn't entirely a failure, but it wasn't a success. I mean, they obviously moved away from him and went back to Hogan. So, but yeah, at some point, the fans choose who they choose. So you're sort of stuck with what they, you know, with what they want, you know. So you have to kind of come up with stories with the characters that the fans want you to, and maybe those aren't the characters that you're interested in or able to tell good stories to or what have you. I mean, that there's that element too.
It almost makes me sound like I'm like kind of bitter that he didn't have like more of a run or they didn't do more with him. But it's like you're saying, I mean, that's a great point, is the fans like you until they don't like you anymore, and you don't get all these. It's not, you know, you don't get the nine lives, you know, you'd like Hogan somehow done where he, you know, reinvented himself and he's kept himself relatively fresh for a lot of years.
Yeah.
That's not normal. That's not the norm at all.
Mm-hmm.
The norm is, you know, we like you for a while, and then we don't like you anymore because we're kind of tired of you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like we want somebody else, something new, something fresh, like punk now, and it could be 6 months and no one will care. You know what I mean? So it's like it's tough to maintain that. So
yeah.
I don't know why I'm harping on it too much about Warwood, but yeah. It just seemed weird to me that he was so high and then so low, and it just seemed like it happened fast enough where it's just like it's just weird to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's
turned into a complete dissection of the Ultimate Warriors.
So. Yeah, I feel like we should we should have been on that DVD, the Self-Destruction of the Ultimate Warrior. We should have explained we should have the segment on there. I'm sure it would have sold even better.
Yeah, we would have. Well, and they would have been like, man, why did he fall so fast? Well, because what can you do with a guy like that? He's so limited in what he does. If your gimmick is to run out super fast to the ring, do 6 laps around a steel cage, blow yourself up completely, and rely on the other guy to carry you through the match, you're probably not going to last very long.
Yeah. Well, so anyway, you have anything you would like to plug for our listeners?
I'll still say to go to Cage. I don't write very much at Cage Side Seats, almost never, because like I said, I'm so... Mania takes up so much of my time. But yeah, I did a post on Cage Side the other night. I was inspired. It was nothing big. I just put a picture up basically. But Punk tweeted a picture of he had the belt in his refrigerator.
Yeah.
And I thought that was slick, so I put it up on Cage Side. So yeah, go read Cage Side. It's a good, they've been doing a lot of great work since the Punk stuff came out.
Yep.
So yeah, they've been covering it like crazy, and they've actually got some really great coverage on the Sin Cara steroid thing that's going on right now. So check them out. And then if you're into MMA, I know a lot of pro wrestling guys are, like me, MMAmania.com for all your MMA needs.
All right, cool. Yeah. And, well, thanks again for being on the show and an in-depth this dissection of the Ultimate Warrior character.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
No problem. And everyone, of course, you can check out fairtoflare.com and wrestlespective.com for all your pro wrestling needs and wants. And keep checking back every day. We'll be having a podcast, Countdown to SummerSlam podcast, talking about each main event up until till SummerSlam 2011. So keep looking out for that. And thanks again for listening.
Let's be honest. Most wrestling websites suck. BS rumors, schoolyard gossip, plagiarism. It's no wonder why no one believes anything they read on the internet. Well, if you can't get something done right, you might as well do it yourself. Presenting the Fair to Flare Quarterly from the writers of fairtoflare.com and over a dozen other wrestling websites. We're not copy and pasting what we read in some newsletter. This is 100% original content from the best wrestling bloggers on the internet. In-depth analysis of the art of pro wrestling, debate, artwork, and humor. The Fair to Flare Quarterly will raise the bar of what wrestling journalism can and should be. Professionally edited and produced, and every contributor will be paid for their work. Order your copy of the Fair to Flare Quarterly today at fairtoflare.com. The better wrestling media has arrived.